Would you all please bow with me? Dear Heavenly Father, Yahweh, thank you for bringing us together to study your word, Father, to praise you. We pray, Father, that we'll recognize your supremeness in this universe, Father, and as we see chaos unravel around us, Father, we pray that you'll protect us and protect your saints. We're looking forward, Father, to the time when Yahshua can return and establish, a righteous government here on earth. But until then, I pray that you'll hold us fast and close to you, Father. And we come to you and ask these things in your son's name, Yahshua. Amen and hallelujah. Are we all set back there? All right. In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of Elohim was hovering over the surface of the waters. That's the opening line of the Bible, but also provides a critical starting point for understanding Yahweh's plan and his purpose for physical Israel, and ultimately for us as part of spiritual Israel. This marks the beginning of time as we know it, the point where Yahweh brought form and structure to the heavens and the earth. Yahweh brought order out of chaos. Today, I'd like to talk about how the Bible portrays this battle between order and chaos, and then talk about life application and the importance of keeping chaos not only out of the assembly, but also out of our relationships with other people. So let's take a closer look. I'm going to start by taking a closer look at this phrase. The earth was without form and void. Have you heard anyone say this Hebrew phrase, tohu wabohu? There's two Hebrew words there, form and void. Tohu, translated here as without form. Bohu, translated here as void. You might see void or emptiness. Bohu, that second word, only appears three times. And every time it's paired up with tohu, tohu wabohu. It appears here. It appears another time in Israel when Israel is prophesying how complete the destruction is going to be for Edom. And then again in Jeremiah 4, where Jeremiah is prophesying about the destruction of Judah. Now, given the context of those passages, when you see tohu and bohu together in judgment against you, you know it's really serious. Because whatever's coming is going to make you formless and void. Tohu, on the other hand, this first word here, appears many places in the Bible, translated many different ways, but often represents destruction, like a city that has been completely destroyed and no longer has structure or form. And it can sometimes represent emptiness or confusion or futility. Isaiah 41:29, I don't have this on the slide, but Isaiah 41:29, for example, talks about the idols of the nations and how meaningless they are and how their images are, quote, nothing but wind and confusion or emptiness. And Isaiah uses that word tohu. So I've got a slide here that kind of talks about what these two Hebrew words are, tohu, bohu. Tohu is confusion, emptiness without form. Same thing with bohu, emptiness without order and void. And this is what I mean by chaos. I mean the lack of order. There's no order. I'm using this word chaos, which actually comes from another Greek word, chaos, which means emptiness, vast, void, chasm, abyss. And even though it's kind of an ancient Greek word, I don't find that word chaos in the Bible, even in Greek manuscripts we have of the Old and New Testament. So today, we'll be looking at other words. We'll be looking at these words, tohu and bohu. We'll be looking at agents of chaos. We'll be looking into the New Testament, too, and looking at some words that they use to represent disorder. So we understand from Genesis that although the heavens and the earth started out dark, they started out formless and empty, Yahweh brought order. The result was this beautiful garden, two humans living in this beautiful garden with free will. And then you go to Genesis 3, and you get that story of a serpent who tricked Adam and Eve, resulting in chaos being introduced back into the world. This creation story also resonates through myths that surround this idea of chaos. Dragons and serpents often represent primordial chaos, you know, this chaos that was at the beginning of time, or this disorder that existed before the creation of the world. In many creation myths, there is a god or a hero that must defeat some chaotic dragon or a serpent to establish order again. And you can kind of see how it borrows from the creation story. In Egyptian mythology, for example, the concept of chaos and disorder is called Isfet. And it's represented in Egyptian stories through symbols like a serpent named Apophis. You can see here that Isfet in Egyptian mythology represents injustice, chaos, violence, sometimes personified by the serpent that I just mentioned. Sometimes you'll hear the serpent called Apep. In one myth, the serpent would battle the sun god Ra, you know, this is Egyptian mythology, battle him every day. The serpent trying to prevent Ra from rising again at dawn. Ra battles Apep using his divine powers and ultimately triumphing in the minds of the Egyptians to bring order and light back into the world with each sunrise. So knowing this, you can imagine how much disruption that plague of darkness in Moses' time, the ninth plague of darkness, would cause Pharaoh and the Egyptians who believed in this myth. Darkness covered the land of Egypt for 3 days. So in their minds, they must have been wondering, well, what's happening here? The sun god Ra is not successfully defeating the serpent of chaos. On the other side of the balance that I have here is order and justice, called Maat, represented by a goddess. And I find this interesting because Egyptian ideas like this would have undoubtedly been known by ancient Israel. And when Yahweh proved himself to be in control of Pharaoh and in control of what happened to the nation of Egypt, he was disrupting their whole belief system. For example, Pharaoh played a crucial role in maintaining this concept of order, Maat, in the cosmos. He was an earthly representation of the deities that they worshipped. And he was seen as a mediator between the divine and the mortal realms. And Pharaoh's authority and actions were believed to be essential for preventing this chaos from disrupting the natural and the social order, ensuring prosperity for the kingdom, for Egypt. This included, for example, regulating the Nile River. You know, the Nile River had natural cycles. It would flow more, it would sometimes less, and the Egyptians counted on that as a source of life because they needed that water. If the flow was too chaotic, you know, causing flooding, or it was too dry, you know, and it was unexpected, his authority was questioned. This is Pharaoh's authority. It was questioned, which, you know, I guess is not too much different than today, where people look around in the U.S. and they say, hey, things were better 4 years ago. What's going on? And they point to the guy who's in office. You know, little do they realize that, you know, as we approach the end of age, things are going to spiral out of control. We are going to see more chaos. Here's a depiction from the tomb of Ramses I, showing a deity, Atum, who they believe was the creator of the world, repelling this serpent, Apep, you know, who was this representation of chaos and darkness. This is from the tomb of Ramses I, 19th dynasty. So this is from a long, long time ago. I mean, we're talking ancient Israel. Here's a depiction of this goddess, Maat, who was a personification of truth, justice, and the cosmic order. So she was just a representation in their minds of order, the opposite of chaos. The feather you see here in the picture, you know, it's often depicted as an ostrich feather, is an element in the judgment that happens to Egyptians in the afterlife, in their mind. You know, the hearts of the dead, here's what the myth is, and I know you've heard this before, probably from the pulpit, but the heart, this feather was put in a balance, and the person who was dead, their heart was taken and put in this balance, and, you know, if the person had lived a good life, then their heart would be as light as a feather, and then they could proceed into the afterlife, you know, full of riches and bliss. But if the heart was heavier, you know, burdened by sin and wrongdoing, it would be devoured by another deity, another monster, resulting in the person's soul being condemned. So you may ask, why are we talking so much about Egyptian mythology? Well, I became interested in this a month or two ago, because in our weekly Bible study, we're studying through the book of Ezekiel. Oh, and this morning's study was so good. I should have been working on this sermon, but I was captivated by Ezekiel 38 and 39. We were talking about the battle of Gog and Magog. So if you want to get in on this, reach out to Lucas. I'm going to say Lucas. Reach out to Lucas and come to our weekly Bible study. But, you know, this was several weeks ago. We were talking about a time in Israel's history when Babylon destroyed Jerusalem, carried off Judah to captivity, and Ezekiel has all these prophecies against Egypt. And when you understand their belief system, you understand how hard these prophecies were hitting Egypt. For example, Ezekiel tells Pharaoh that he's going to die like those on the battlefield. You know, basically, die by those who die by the sword on the battlefield, so you're not going to get a proper burial. And that was really important to Pharaoh. So he's hitting home into, like, preventing him from getting to the afterlife that he was looking at. He also prophesies how Pharaoh was muddying up the waters of the Nile. And I have a couple examples here from Ezekiel, and this is really what spawned my interest in this. So I've got two verses here. One's from Ezekiel 29:3. It says, "Behold, I am against you, O Pharaoh of Egypt, O great monster that lies among the rivers, who says, 'The Nile is mine, I made it myself.'" And then in Ezekiel 32:2, "You are like a lion among the nations. You are like a monster in the seas. You thrash about in your rivers, churning up the waters with your feet and muddying the streams." I've highlighted the word monster here because in both of these verses, it's the same word. And it is translated a few different ways throughout the Bible. Sometimes it's dragon, sometimes it's sea monster, sometimes it's serpent. But here, especially in Ezekiel 32, it might even be appropriate to understand this monster as being like a crocodile, right? Because he's saying that Pharaoh churns up the water with his feet. Some commentators think that this is talking about Pharaoh disrupting the calm of the Nile River. Remember that Pharaoh was supposed to be in control of the chaos, but instead, I mean, he's being accused of causing it, churning up the waters with your feet and muddying the streams. And since this word also is used to represent a serpent, you know, it's possible that Ezekiel was relating Pharaoh to that serpent of chaos that they believed in. You know, the very thing he was supposed to be able to control, he actually became the bringer of chaos. But it wasn't just Egypt. There were other societies that had similar beliefs in their mythos that were like this. Here's another example from the Mesopotamians. So this Mesopotamians, by Mesopotamians, I mean the Assyrians to the north, the Babylonians to the east. So these were nations that kind of surrounded Israel. And this is ancient too. They believed that Tiamat, a primordial sea goddess depicted as a dragon, embodies chaos. And then there's another deity here called Marduk that defeats her to create the world. So again, you see, these are kind of like callbacks to the creation story. Now, they've perverted it a little bit, but again, you have these societies, ancient societies, that represented chaos with serpents and with dragons like this. And I don't have time today to talk about other societies. I was thinking about making slides for them, but like the Norse had a belief in what they called the Midgard serpent, which would bring about Ragnarok. And maybe some of you have heard that because it's in pop culture now. But Ragnarok was that final war fought at the end of this world, leading to the rebirth of the world. Excuse me. The Indians also had an ancient belief that was similar to this, related to a serpent that represented chaos. And understanding these foreign beliefs helps us to understand the context in which some of the scriptures condemn these foreign deities, how Yahweh continually shows that he's above all of them. It also shows that they likely modeled these beliefs after the creation story in Genesis. I mean, we have a serpent or other beast, like here, it looks like a dragon with legs, that represent chaos And they also believe in deities or representatives on earth, like Pharaoh, that are supposed to keep chaos in check. Even in biblical literature, there are several references to how Yahweh has destroyed agents of chaos represented by sea monsters or dragons or serpents. Two of them are specifically named. Maybe you haven't heard about this, but there's a creature named Rahab, and then everyone has heard of Leviathan. So those are the two creatures that were named. Rahab, a sea monster, and Leviathan, a twisting serpent, like described in Job 26. I won't have time to put that on the slide, but we're going to look at several other examples. Described in Job and even in Psalms, and these were formidable forces that challenged Yahweh's sovereignty and order, at least they thought they were challenging Yahweh's order. Let's start in Isaiah. Isaiah 51:9. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in the ancient days and the generations of old. Are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart and wounded the serpent? Again, this is the same word we've been seeing. Serpent could also be translated as dragon or sea monster, the same one that was applied to Egypt. And if you continue to verse 10, again, I don't have it on the slide, but if you look at verse 10, you can see it's in the context of crossing the Red Sea. So we understand that Rahab here represented Egypt. And a lot of time, you know, it was just a nickname for Egypt. And Isaiah here is talking about Yahweh's faithfulness through history. This word Rahab is a word defined as, quote, storm. And in this verse, Rahab could be translated literally as the one who acts like a storm or acts stormily or boisterously or arrogantly. Those are all other definitions for that word, Rahab. Here's another verse that shows that this creature was used to represent Egypt. This is Isaiah 30, verse 7. Egypt's help is futile and empty. Therefore, I have called her Rahab, who stands still. Now, this is particularly amusing because now we know that this word Rahab means a storm or something that acts boisterously, you know, representing that chaos. But here, they're saying, you know, Egypt probably thinks of themselves as a force to be reckoned with, but it's Rahab who sits still. So it's kind of a jab at Egypt here. You know, the nation that acts boisterously or arrogantly, but really doesn't do anything. There are examples in Judah's history, and we studied this in Ezekiel, where we have a king of Judah that went to Egypt for help. Like, oh no, the Babylonians are coming in. Please help us, Egypt, to defeat these Babylonians. And it fell through. The Egyptians had to run back to Egypt because they couldn't help. So again, Rahab who sits still. Psalm 89 makes reference to Rahab in the context of Yahweh's enemies. And again, commentators believe that this is a reference to Egypt. I don't have it on the slide. Psalm 89:10, you crushed Rahab like a carcass. You scattered your enemies with your mighty arm. But I wanted to specifically mention this verse, Psalm 74. Psalm 74, and this is verses 12 through 14. Yet Elohim is my king from ancient time, working salvation on the earth. You divided the sea by your strength. You smashed the heads of the dragons of the sea. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You fed him to the creatures of the desert. Again, we see another Hebrew word here. We haven't talked about this one yet, but, you know, Leviathan is another word like serpent that means serpent or sea monster or dragon, and it seems like it might be a proper name for one of these creatures. Yahweh crushed the heads of Leviathan. And you can see this concept of Rahab or Leviathan or serpent woven throughout biblical literature. There are actually multiple references in Job that I won't have time to get to today, but Job makes references to all three of these, the serpent, Rahab, and Leviathan. And we see references to Yahweh shattering these agents of chaos, these ancient agents of chaos. But when will the ultimate source of chaos be destroyed for good? You know, that's my big question. Excuse me. Isaiah 27:1. In that day, Yahweh will punish with his sword, his fierce, great, and powerful sword, Leviathan the gliding serpent, Leviathan the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea. It says in that day, and it's talking about the day of Yahweh. In a couple minutes, I'm going to tie this idea of the monster of the sea being a representation of Satan. We're going to do that in the book of Revelation. But first, there is one more belief system that I wanted to mention. It represents a more modern mindset, if you will. And I say modern because it's popular now, even though this idea that I'm about to introduce goes back to ancient Greeks, at least. It's this modern belief on natural chaos and where order came from. So the modern belief is that we had chaos, emptiness, basically, I guess, a big ball of energy, if you want to describe it that way. And through time and chance, we ended up with order, life, and structure. You know, but so they're removing intelligent design out of the picture, but you still need a way to explain where all that energy came from. You know, today it's stored in all the structured matter that we see. What prompted life to start? You know, how did matter go from non-living to living? What was the origin of consciousness? How did the first creature become self-aware? How was it able to go back? How was it able to think and reason? These are all questions we have, and, you know, science doesn't have an explanation for it, but so this is their theory that, you know, given enough time, you know, given enough chance, that order and life and structure can come from chaos. Now, we recognize Yahweh here. We recognize Yahweh as the sovereign creator who brings order out of chaos. The serpent in the Garden of Eden tempted mankind, brought chaos and evil into the world. And then, like I said, in a few minutes, I'll show that serpent is our primary adversary and the bringer of chaos, described of Satan, which is from a Hebrew word that just means adversary or opponent. And he brings chaos through manipulation and deception. And we can see that right in the creation story. So I said before that Yahweh was the sovereign creator who brings order out of chaos. And the New Testament writers realized, you know, there's a little bit more to the story than that. Yahshua was also a creation, and that order brought to the chaos was brought by Yahweh working through Yahshua. So I'm going to go to Colossians 1, 15 and 17, where it says, Yahshua is the image of the invisible Elohim, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities. And I think some of these are references to the spiritual realm here too. So visible and invisible. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So you have an explanation here for all of these forces that we experience day to day, but, you know, might not actually be able to see, the visible and the invisible. So if I go back to the last slide, now we can modify this, you know, this idea of chaos, and this is the biblical belief on natural chaos. And we can show that it's Yahweh's spirit working through Yahshua that actually brought order, life, and structure. Now, we still witness chaos in the natural world, right? We look around us. We see chaos in the people that we deal with. We see chaos in nature. I gave the example earlier of the Nile River. You know, it has ebbs and flows, and sometimes it does unexpected things. We just had a Hurricane Beryl. Just came through Texas and through the Midwest, and now I think it's up in Canada, but left many in Texas without power. The Bible gives examples of how Yahweh is still able to control this chaos, and even Yahshua is able to control this chaos. I wanted to give one example, and this had a lot of impact on me. In Matthew 23, so the context is Yahshua and the disciples are in a boat in the Sea of Galilee, and a storm comes in and crashes over the boat. And somehow Yahshua was able to sleep through that, and that makes me think he was really at peace. to be able to sleep through this storm when all of the disciples were panicking. And so I'm going to start in actually 25, verse 25. And they came to him and woke him. They woke Yahshua, saying, "Save us, Master, we are perishing." And he said, "Why are you afraid, you men of little faith?" He got up, he rebuked the winds and the sea, and it became perfectly calm. So Yahshua brought peace out of chaos. The men were amazed and said, "What kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" So just like Yahweh in the Old Testament, you know, controlled the sea. You know, we've got references in Job, references in Psalms. Controlled those representations of chaos through Leviathan and Rahab. Even Yahshua has the authority to calm the storm and bring peace where there's chaos. So even in what we perceive as chaos, Yahweh has control. And there is a future that we're all hoping to be part of where order and justice are restored once and for all, and chaos and evil are destroyed. In 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter prophesies that in the future the earth will undergo a complete breakdown. And I see this similar to a return to the chaos that existed before creation, or at least during the time of the flood. And Peter, you know, in this chapter, let me go ahead and just go over to the verse. But Peter is addressing skeptics who mock the promise of Yahshua's return. They say, you know, the world's continuing on like it has since the beginning of creation. You know, where is Yahshua? You think he's going to return? But Peter reminds them that Yahweh once destroyed the world with water, and now the present heavens and earth are going to be destroyed with fire. And he says in 2 Peter 3, verse 5, "But they deliberately overlook the fact." Now he's talking about the skeptics here who say this. "They deliberately overlook the fact that long ago by Elohim's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world of that time perished in the flood." So you've already got like a worldwide event here that kind of wiped the slate clean. "And by the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for a day of judgment and destruction of unrighteous men." So Peter emphasizes here that just as the flood came due to widespread wickedness, and you can read about that in Genesis 6, so too this impending judgment by fire reflects Yahweh's righteous judgment against, what is it? Human sin, human idolatry. I was going to put a verse up in Romans 1, but if you go through Romans 1, you can see Paul is very clearly laying out the need for that judgment, because men's heart have gotten very, very wicked. So this judgment serves as both a purification and a restoration of Yahweh's order and justice. And so like that original sin in the garden that brought chaos in, and you know, that chaos is in the form of death, it's in the form of pain, it's in the form of sin. Unrighteousness and wickedness brought a flood in Genesis 6. And in the future, that unrighteousness and wickedness is going to bring fire. And at the root of all of this chaos is the deceiver. So here I want to turn over to Revelation, and he confirms that Satan is the same being that was in the garden that first deceived mankind. Revelation 12:9. "So the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." The Greek word here used for devil, diabolos, means slanderous or accusing falsely. And the Greek word here for Satan, so there's two things. There's two ways they're describing him. First is the slanderer or the deceptor. Secondly, Satan, as Satan, which is, you know, a Greek representation of that Hebrew word I mentioned earlier, which just means adversary or opponent. But this emphasizes the consistent portrayal of Satan through Israel's history as one who opposes and seeks to disrupt Yahweh's order. And recognizing the destructive potential of such chaos, even the New Testament leaders emphasized that it was necessary to maintain order, not only in your personal lives, but also in the assembly. So I'd like to transition and kind of talk about more of the life application here. Let's look at a couple examples to understand how the leaders of the Apostolic Assembly sought to bring an environment of peace and an environment of harmony to contrast this chaos that Satan was trying to cause. So Peter, the first example, Peter wrote to the Corinthian Assembly. We have two letters in our Bible, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians 14, it sounds like the members of this assembly had really gotten wrapped up into spiritual gifts. And Paul was encouraging them. He's like, yeah, this is great. You really want these spiritual gifts. But they were so focused on being able to talk in tongues. And he pointed out that, you know, it's great that you want to seek these spiritual gifts, but maybe the gift of prophecy would be more edifying to the whole assembly. Because when you're talking in tongues, the people around you can't understand what you're saying unless they have the gift of interpretation, right? And so everyone seemed to be wrapped up in talking in tongues, but Paul gives them some advice about how to bring order back to what he perceived as chaos that was happening in the assembly. And as you read through this, you might say, hey, this is great advice for us today. For example, how to run a Bible study. And this is actually how we do it. If you want to say something in the Bible study, you raise your hand, you get put on the list, and you'll be able to talk when it's your turn. And this is to keep everyone from talking over each other, or so that we're not sitting there watching a dialogue happening between two people the whole time. So 1 Corinthians 14, the text is a little small here. I'm going to jump around a little bit. I'm going to start in verse 29. So he says, two or three prophets should speak, and the others should weigh carefully what is said. And if a revelation comes to someone who is seated, the first speaker should stop. For you can all prophesy in turn, so that everyone may be instructed and encouraged. So this is applied to those who actually have the gift of prophecy, you know, so that everyone's just not talking over each other. But I found it interesting how prescriptive this is. It's like, okay, two or three people should speak. Others should weigh carefully. You know, if there's someone who's seated, the first speaker should stop and let the other person stand up and speak so that you can prophesy in turn. And then in verse 33, it says, for Yahweh is not an Elohim of disorder. And that's the word I wanted to focus on in the New Testament. This idea of chaos is wrapped up in this Greek word for disorder. For Yahweh is not an Elohim of disorder, but of peace. And so this is the big contrast that Paul's making here. You've got disorder on one hand, chaos on one hand, and then peace and order on the other hand. And he says, as in all the assemblies of the saints. And then jumping to verse 40, he wraps it up by saying, everything must be done in a proper and orderly manner. Again, this word for disorder here, you know, it's translated as disorder, but it also means instability. It means a disturbance. It can mean confusion. And later, when Paul wrote the second letter to the Corinthians that we have, he was worried about visiting them and finding this disorder or instability. And I don't have this up on the slide, but it's 2 Corinthians 12. And in verse 20, he lists this idea of disorder. He was really worried he was going to go visit them and then everything would be chaotic again. But he's like, you know, I'm worried I'm going to come and I'm going to witness quarreling, jealousy, anger, contentions, slander, gossip, conceit. And he groups all this in with this concept of disorder. So these are the things that bring chaos to an assembly: the quarreling, the jealousy, the anger, the contentions, the slander, the gossip, the conceit. And another warning about chaos to the assembly in Ephesians 4. Again, you can write this down if you want to look it up later. Ephesians 4, in verse 14, Paul warned the assembly at Ephesus not to be tossed back and forth by the waves, blown here and there by every wind of teaching, and by the cunning and craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. So you've got a couple of key words there. First of all, you got the back and forth of the waves that kind of demonstrate that chaos that we've been talking about. And then you've also got this craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. So Paul warned the assembly, you know, watch out for this. Be careful not to get caught up in that chaos. Every wind of teaching. In other words, false teachings and deceptive practices can lead to doctrinal confusion and spiritual instability. And Paul was warning against that. Now I'm going to transition over to James, who makes this idea of disorder and chaos in our life a little bit more personal. James 3, verse 14. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, There you will find disorder and every evil practice. This is a message about battling spiritual chaos, but here is your recipe if you want to nurture spiritual chaos, if you want to feed chaos, if you want to be an agent of chaos. Feed your envy and feed your selfishness. If you want to bring order and peace, on the other hand, then you need to get rid of envy. Think of ways that you can serve others. Let's go back a few verses and see what the alternative is to this disorder that James is talking about. Now, this is probably the longest passage I have here. It's James 3, and I'm going to start in verse 13, and then we'll go back through verse 18 again. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good conduct, by deeds done with humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every evil practice. But the wisdom from above is first of all pure, then peace-loving, gentle, accommodating, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap the fruit of righteousness. So again, you want a recipe for chaos? Harbor bitter jealousy, harbor selfish ambition, boast in it, deny that there's anything wrong with you, deny that you need to change. But James is saying that that type of attitude is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. I mean, that's the way to let Satan cause chaos and disorder in your life. Are you the type of person who enjoys causing chaos? Okay. This next series of questions might be a little tough to get through, but do you like to instigate others until they are angry? Do you deliberately stir up conflict or drama within your group of friends or your group of believers? Do you enjoy seeing other people have to deal with chaotic situations? Do you enjoy watching people struggle? I mean, these are the types of things that should raise a red flag for you. By the way, as a father, I was thinking about this last night. I'm still learning ways that I should apply Paul's instruction in Ephesians 6. I'm looking at my son back there, where he tells fathers not to provoke children to anger. And I mean, is that because fathers are prone to being unsympathetic to their children when we discipline them? I mean, that seems to be the context of Ephesians 6, you know, fathers being unreasonable and severe instead of nurturing them in the admonition of Yahweh. So, I mean, it's a warning to all fathers. But, I mean, fathers apparently can influence their children and cause chaos in their children's lives. So we have to be, you know, fathers, you need to be aware of that. The alternative here in James is to be a peacemaker. A peacemaker. And if you missed it, you can go back a few weeks and listen to Lucas's sermon. He explained the importance of not just being a peacekeeper, but stepping up, as hard as it might be, and actually creating peace. I mean, I would relate it to Yahshua calming the storm, taking chaos, removing the chaos, and bringing peace. And if you are the one who can bring peace to a chaotic situation, then you will reap the fruit of righteousness. So there's a lot of information to bring together here. So I talked about how Yahweh created matter and structure out of chaos, or created out of disorder through Yahshua. I talked about how Yahshua has authority over chaos. We looked at the example of how he's able to control the wind and the waves. And the reason it had such a big impact on me is because I think it kind of harkens back to what Yahweh was doing in the Old Testament when he was slaying these agents of chaos that were in the sea. And then Yahshua was able to demonstrate that authority over the wind and the waves to his disciples. Another example we didn't talk about with Yahshua is his temptation in the wilderness. I mean, he had Satan there trying to deceive him into serving him. And Yahshua was able to resist that. I talked about Satan in the form of a serpent deceiving mankind, bringing chaos back into the world at the Garden of Eden. We talked about a few other cultures, I mean, especially the Egyptians, who represented chaos through a serpent or a dragon, and how these Old Testament prophets, poets, and psalmists also represented the enemies of Yahweh as a serpent or a dragon, likely playing on this idea of serpents and dragons representing chaos. And their writings show, I'm talking about the psalmists, the prophets, the poets, their writings show over and over again that Yahweh is supreme and has power over this chaos. We talked about how in the time coming, similar to the flood, you know, the earth will be melted down in some way into a semi-chaotic state, you know, similar to the flood, the time of the flood, so it can be rebuilt. Finally, I talked about the importance of maintaining order in the assembly and in our lives. But the main thing I want to impress upon you is that we cannot promote or embrace chaos, because that would make us an enemy of Yahweh. We have to be careful about this, because the Bible consistently presents Yahweh as an Elohim of order, an Elohim of peace and righteousness, and it warns against chaos and disorder and rebellion. I'll group that in there too. In closing, I'll mention Revelation 20. I don't have it up on the slide, but it talks about the final destruction of the devil, who, again, we realize has been the primary agent of chaos throughout history. He will be destroyed, and so will death. Revelation 21 gives us a glimpse into the new heaven and earth, where Yahweh promises to restore that perfect order and peace. You know, it harkens back to that time in the Garden of Eden before the serpent deceived Adam and Eve. Revelation 21:4 says, "No more crying or pain, for the former things have passed away." You know, as we reflect on these promises, let's hold fast to the hope that Yahweh's ultimate victory over chaos will bring the establishment of eternal peace. And may Yahweh bless you. Thank you for your attention.